Welcome back to the program. We've done dozens and dozens of programs about change, how communication, shopping, and virtually all aspects of life are no longer the way they once were. Today we turn our attention to an institution that the more it changes, the more it remains the same. An appetizing store on Manhattan's Lower East Side that from its pushcart beginnings in 1907 to the new family members running it today has remained a beacon for smoked salmon, herring, chopped liver, and caviar. But more importantly, it's the story about how one family persevered and grew a business around all the change of 20th century New York. Mark Russ Fetterman took over running Russ and Daughter in 1978 and a couple of years ago turned it over to the fourth generation. He tells his appetizing story in Russ and Daughter, Reflections and Recipes from the House That Herring Built. It is my pleasure to welcome Mark Russ Fetterman to the program. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
And thanks for asking me.
Great to have you here. One of the things that you point out, and I want us to get this correct at the very beginning, that Russ and Daughters is not a deli. It's an appetizer store. Explain that.
In fact, if it's anything, it's probably the antithesis of the deli or delicatessen. You know, these days, deli could mean anything. It's usually some convenience store on the corner run by an ethnic family. But delicatessen comes from originally the French word delicatesse, meaning delicious, to the Germanic delicatessen that got transported here, particularly to the Lower East Side, which was a German, not Jewish, but German neighborhood in the mid to late 1800s. So the delicatessen was primarily serving meats, cured, smoked, pickled meats. So you've got pastrami, salami, corned beef, brisket. And because the big wave of Jews that came from 1880 to 1920 brought with them their kosher laws, you could not eat meat and dairy together, nor could you basically sell them in the same place. And appetizing, generally meaning initially herring and then smoked fish, is eaten with dairy products, that is cream cheese or butter or sour cream sauce for the herring. So they were not served in the same stores, and we had then a wave of stores called that became called appetizing for want of a better word. Nobody really knows who the genius was who thought of putting appetizing on top of the door, but I guess somebody was looking down the block. Irving was probably looking down the block at Saul's Delicatessen and saying, delicious? No, my stuff is appetizing. So that's how we have it. At one point, there were 20 or 30 appetizing stores on the Lower East Side alone. And they were serving basically foods that were cheap in those days. In the 1930s, through the 1930s, lox, most people call it lox, but generally it's smoked salmon, was about 9 cents a quarter of a pound or 35 cents a pound. Things change, you know, dealing with fish that disappears, and things got a lot more expensive. To answer, maybe if I remember your original question, we are not a deli. We are an appetizing store.
And when Joel Russ, your grandfather, started this, it was really about selling herring out of a barrel.
That's all that existed in those days. Herring, and we're really talking about primarily one kind of herring, Northern Atlantic fat herrings, and in Yiddish, fat is schmaltz. So most people who know this kind of stuff assume that schmaltz is chicken fat, but it just means fat. And the fat herrings from the North Atlantic were considered the best herrings, and that's what actually all cultures in Northern Europe were eating, but particularly the Jews. It was cheap. Marc Chagall's father was a herringmonger selling those kinds of herrings in Russia, and that actually appears in some of his paintings, a wizened old guy with a black caftan schlepping herring barrels. But that was the food fish, and it was because there was no refrigeration then. Before refrigeration, the preservative, the way to preserve these fish was to just dump them in big wooden barrels with a lot of salt brine, and then you could keep it for a couple of years that way, and they actually got better. That's what was brought over to the Lower East Side, that food fish, the schmaltz herring, salt cured in a barrel, in big wooden barrels. That's how it started. But then fish, lox, entered the spectrum of food, because this continent was, or at least the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans were teeming with salmon, and lox, L-O-X, is from the Germanic lax, L-A-C-H-S, meaning salmon. And basically what was happening in the late 1800s, where they were catching huge amounts of salmon in the Pacific Northwest, Alaska, on down to California, and dumping those into huge tierces, basically big wooden vats, filling it with salt brine, a lot of salt, and shipping them to New York ports for transshipment to Europe. There wasn't a lot of salmon there. But some of it stayed in New York, and the Jews on the Lower East Side then were more adventurous with food, if in fact the food was kosher and salmon is kosher fish. So that sort of became a staple, not a staple, but a fairly commonplace on the Lower East Side in those days. And not shortly after that, smoking became available, and the salmon was perfect for smoking, and we have smoked salmon.
One of the things that's so fascinating, and you write about this in Russ and Daughters, is that given these humble kind of populist beginnings, that it all became kind of gourmet as time went on, and basically you were still selling the same thing.
Right, so if you wait long enough, you know, things may turn around in your favor. Bagels and lox have, you know, gone from ethnic to mainstream. And I write, the humble herring has become haute cuisine. It's because it's basically good food, you know, and it's direct. There's not a lot you have to do with a smoked salmon except put it on a piece of bread or a bagel or even just a plate. So it appeals to many different cultural tastes. I mean, people, it's, you know, lots of Chinese come in the store now. We used to be, you talk about changes, I mean, that's what your program is about. We used to be a Jewish store in a Jewish neighborhood selling Jewish food to Jewish customers. That was pretty much our identity. All right. And just about every part of that sentence is different, is changed. And the food, or the customer base that used to be primarily Yiddish-speaking, now have accents that are British and Italian and German and Spanish and French, just about everything. And very little Yiddish is heard in the store these days. And the food stuff, you know, it's mainstream. Everybody knows bagels and lox now, thank goodness.
And much of the change that you're talking about is because the Lower East Side of New York, the area surrounding the store, has changed so dramatically.
Yes, it has. That's also sort of a shocking kind of concept. The Lower East Side, from its very beginnings, was an immigrant catch basin. And the tenements of the Lower East Side, which are now, you know, we're now denominated an historic district because of these tenements, but they were badly constructed, multiple dwellings, designed poorly, cheaply constructed, just to house immigrants while they were working their way into society. And so the concept for the big wave of Jewish immigrants was, okay, you landed in Ellis Island, you went to the Lower East Side, not far away, and generally you stayed on the floor of some relative, a distant cousin, aunt or uncle or whatever, until you could figure out how to get out of the Lower East Side. It was always an exodus out of the Lower East Side, and now it's not an exodus back, whatever that's called. I mean, the young fourth, fifth, sixth generation kids are coming back and renting apartments in walk-up tenements and paying huge amounts of money and then telling their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, hey, guess where I'm living? I'm on the Lower East Side, and they're going on the other end of the conversation. What, are you crazy? You know how hard we work to get out of this neighborhood. So it all is turned around, and basically the point of writing this book was for me finally to take a deep breath and reflect on what was happening, what had happened, opposed to being reactive when you're running a business. Reflect on, you know, the things that I was doing while I was running a business. Were they really that different than my father, my parents and aunts and uncles had done all those years? How much of it was the same, and how much of it had changed over these years? We had a particularly interesting or unique perspective on what was happening from behind the counter of our little appetizing store. The world was coming to us, and telling us what was going on, and we were watching it in our own neighborhood, and in some cases we were participating in it.
Even beyond the Lower East Side, New York itself had changed so dramatically during this period. When you took over the business in the late 1970s, New York was in a pretty tough state, and through the 80s, not too good either. And in fact, that all changed dramatically. Talk about it from the reactive point of view and what it was like watching that from behind the counter.
The best explanation, the best response to that is one word, oy. I grew up, I was born on the Lower East Side. My family's business, Russ and Daughters, was there, so I was there. I worked there as a kid. I don't think until I took it over, I really had a sense of how bad it was, and it was getting even worse. The city seems to me had, by and large, abandoned the Lower East Side. It had, you know, various ethnic groups, none of which had a sufficient or significant voting bloc to exert any pressure on providing services to the Lower East Side. So you didn't have the police presence and the sanitation presence and the social services that really that neighborhood demanded. And consequently, it was in free fall. It was dirty and dangerous. People didn't want to come down to shop. They wanted our product. Russ Daughters was always known as having the best product. But they were afraid to because, I mean, the Jews had long since left, I think by the 1950s, two-thirds or three-quarters of the Jewish population had left the Lower East Side. So it's not like we had a customer base right there at that point. So they had to travel into us from the suburbs, from the outer boroughs. And they, if it was bad weather, or even if it wasn't bad weather, they didn't want to come afraid that if they parked their car, it would be broken into and their stuff would be stolen. And guess what? That was what was happening. And what you'd see passing in front of the store, the big window of the store, were basically the denizens of the Lower East Side, pimps and prostitutes and petty criminals on their way someplace to commit petty crimes. It was just terrible. We own the building, and in our family, we're not big on paying rent to anybody. And so I stayed, and I watched all of this happening, often wondering what would die first, my business or me. And you don't want to be the Russ generation that kills this business, right? So it's like, cause you know you'll be haunted forever. So I just sort of, it was a struggle every day and to get the customers in, wonder if they were going to come in, wonder if the help was going to come in, and get through the day. And so that started to change, I would say, in the late 80s. Other places around us, like the East Village, had changed before us. I don't know if you're familiar with the East Village. The East Village basically got the changes when the West Village, which was originally bohemian area and arty, and when that became too pricey for the artists, they moved to the East Village. And then when that became too pricey, they moved to the Lower East Side. So the Lower East Side was sort of the last place to get this gentrification. People now they think they're wistful for what the Lower East Side was, but if they knew what it really was, they would not be.
How did you keep the business going? How did you keep the doors open?
Gee, I don't know. like I said, it's fear. A lot of it is fear. If you're a Russ, I'm the third generation Russ, you don't want to be the one that presides over the death of Russ and Daughters. So you just do what you have to do, and it's not like we were making a lot of money. So a lot of what had to be done, I did myself, whether it was, you know, cleaning the floors, wiping the counters down, ordering the merchandise, paying the bills, or the bills, you know, you took home at night to pay. You just keep the... You keep the costs down as much as you can and work as hard as you can. I think we always had, you know, people who really wanted to come to us. It was about the quality, but it was also about they had an emotional and generational connection with Russ and Daughters. So buying our fish was something more than a commercial transaction. They were connecting because their parents and grandparents had shopped there and bought stuff from my parents and grandparents. So we always had a customer base, but it was never like, a major, thriving, exciting business like it is today. So you just do it. Every day you need to open the store and get the right fish in the store. And you need to line up as perfectly as possible, counterman, customer, and a piece of fish hundreds of times a day. And then you got to close, roll down the gates at night, and, you know, do the same thing the next day. You just sort of do it. There's no brilliance here. There really is no brilliance. You just do it.
You talked about having the best products. Talk about the quality control.
Quality control is in the hands and the palate of Russ always. So we're the ones who are selecting the fish. Part of it is a genetic, some gene that's connected to the taste of smoked fish and herring. But we do that. Each generation learns from the generation before, and that's the most important part of the learning process, how to tell a good fish from a bad fish. If you were to go into a store that was substantially involved in the selling of smoked fish, you might see several kinds of smoked salmon, and they would all look the same to you. But I assure you, they're all different. And so the trick is, how do you buy the best fish? And especially if you're starting with the presumption that only 10% of a batch of fish is really the cream, the stuff that you really want to sell to your customers, then there's maybe 50, 60% is okay, fine, okay for selling, and then there's whatever the math is, 30 or 40% of you really don't want to sell that if it belongs in a supermarket. So how do you get the best fish? Well, there's a couple of things involved. One is you got to be able to know what the best fish is. As I said, it all pretty much looks the same. And that's part of our Russ family, you know, handing. That's the education. And then you have to buy a lot of it because you want the smokers to pay attention because you're a big customer. And we sell a lot of smoked fish. And so we have their attention. And thirdly, you got to pay your bills. That's part of also the Russ business model. You pay your bills within a week. And so then you really have their attention. So that's basically what it is.
Now the business is run by your daughter, by the next generation. Talk about what she got from watching you behind the counter all of those years and why she was willing to take it over.
Oh, those are some good questions. I'm trying to figure that out now because I can't even tell you really why I gave up practice of law to come back into the business, but I did. But just to correct something that's very important, it's not just my daughter. It's my daughter and my nephew, and they're in equal degrees of consanguinity, if that's the word, to the founder, their great-grandfather, my grandfather. So they're partners. And they're owning and running Russ and Daughters. Here's a bit of irony. The irony is this. I got a really good education. And the point of that is that the first two generations, my grandparents, my parents, aunts, and uncles, they worked so hard for the singular purpose of making sure their children, meaning me, my sisters, my cousins, did not have to do this. That we would not have to work 6 days a week, 10 hours a day, standing on a counter, dealing with the public, coming home smelling like a fish. That maybe we could get a college education, because none of them had it, and work in an office and put on a suit and sit at a desk and work only on weekends. That was their desire. And so we all went to college, and in fact, their ultimate fantasy was that, which is the ultimate Jewish fantasy, which I'm quite sure is the ultimate fantasy of everybody, every ethnic group, is that their kids become professionals, doctor, lawyer, accountant, dentist. So that was the ultimate fantasy. And in my level, the third generation, I'm actually the only one of the seven Russ grandchildren who did that, who lived out their fantasy. I went to law school. I got a law degree. I practiced law. They had bragging rights. My father behind the counter, my son the lawyer. And the irony is that I then gave it up and came in to run the business. So the irony goes on. Now I'm running the business. I know what the world of professional work is. My friends are lawyers and doctors and big businessmen. And for my children, I would prefer that they come in and run Russ and Daughters. So I don't think there was any expectation in the generations above that this is the way it would go. And I think what we do is sort of valuable work in the world. That may sound a bit arrogant because we run this little fish store in the Lower East Side, but I think it's honest and valuable and good-feeling kind of work. So my daughter, I guess, picked up on this. I have two children. I have a son, and I write in the book, I'm the only Jewish father who's disappointed his son wanted to become a doctor. And from an early age, the kid wanted to be a doctor. I'm saying sturgeon. He's thinking surgeon, and he won. So he's actually a doctor, and I'm somewhat teasing. I'm proud of him. He does pediatric oncology at UCLA. And my daughter, who's brilliant and could have done anything in the world, and was on her way to doing pretty much anything in the world, came into the business as a stopover point in the year 2000, I believe it was, or 2001, till she figured out her next move. She was working at the Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco, and then she was working for some international not-for-profit. Over my objection, I said, she told me she was working for not-for-profit. I said, Nikki, we're the Russ family. We do for-profit only. But nonetheless, she did that and then came and was trying to figure out her next move in the world. And as soon as I saw her sort of not engaged, whatever the Jewish Machiavelli is, I gave her an apartment in the tenement that I had renovated above the store. And I just assumed she was coming in to be the heir apparent. Well, that was a wrong assumption. I'm busy introducing her to the world. Hey, everybody, look at my daughter. She's not only pretty, but she's smart and talented and blah, blah, blah. It turns out she didn't want to be my daughter or anybody's daughter. She was in her 20s and wanted to figure out the world. So, of course, that drove her out of the business for another couple of years. And she tried on many hats and many different professions. Until something happened to her, maybe it was some gene that she had that exploded in her, or suddenly revealed itself and said, "You really have fish running through your genome." But she decided to come back, and at that point, I had taken in my nephew, who was an engineer. And that was a big surprise to me. I figured there's no way he knows how to run a smokefish business, an herring business. He's an engineer dealing with computer chips. But he turned out to be a major surprise and take right to it. He can slice with the best of them and run a business and get from point A to point B in a straight line, something I've never been able to do. So I can't tell you, and you'd have to speak to them exactly why they turned around and came in. I couldn't tell you even my own case, why I gave up the practice of law to come in, what really drove it, probably lots of factors, but I think for each one of us, we've done it and we're happy we've done it.
Do you think, and you can, certainly speaking for you, was it the lure of the family business, or was there something else in what the product was, in the location, something else that was just the calling?
That's the great question. I don't know how, maybe all of the above, maybe none of the above. There's something, I tell the story we're all subjected to this as Russes from the time we were kids. If we're not in the store, we're at least aware that something's going on, that we're a little bit different than everybody else. If for no other reason than the smell, our parents coming home smelling a little bit fishy. Nobody else's parents were smelling like that. And our parents worked on the weekends, and everybody else was having fun. So there was something different about us. But somehow along the line, we got a sense that we were special in a way, different and special. And maybe that caught on. In my family, we were required from the time we were 13 on to put in some time in the store. And that was work behind the candy counter. And the purpose of that to our parents and to my parents and aunts and uncles, besides that we were cheap labor, was that we should learn what it was to make a buck. Why is it they came home tired and fishy and grouchy at the end of the day? They wanted us to learn that, and how hard it was, the money that we were going to spend in the movies, a slice of pizza, baseball cards, whatever, where was that coming from? And by virtue of the fact that we had to work in the store from the time we were young and learn what this was, while we were there, I think we were sort of taking in, internalizing the scene there, which is quite unusual. It's not just a commercial transaction of money and fish changing hands across a counter. There is something else going on there. I don't know if I capture it in my book, but basically that place has what's called in Yiddish or in Hebrew, neshoma, soul. And I think to certain of us in the Russ family, fortunately as the generations go down, that relates to our own soul. And that's about as best as I can put why we have given up what we were doing.
Has there ever been a desire to expand?
Yeah, always. You know, when I did it, when I ran business, the most of it, it was, as I said, it was a bad neighborhood. And in the tail end of my career is when everything sort of changed. The neighborhood changed. The food world changed. I mean, when my parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles were running the business, there was no thing like a Food Network, Star Chefs, Chop This, Hot Chefs. That, you know, food was food. And this was still strictly ethnic food. And I was sort of transitional. The food world was largely like that. And it was at the tail end that everything sort of turned around in the food world. I was busy struggling on a day-to-day basis, trying to keep the business alive. While I had the fantasy of expanding, that didn't seem to, and I was doing it pretty much alone. My wife was helping me, but we were pretty much alone. Didn't have a lot of help in those days. So there wasn't a reality to it. I don't know. I do know, because I was on a panel with my daughter and nephew last night, and somebody asked the same question, what about the expansion thing? And they're young, and they're aggressive, and they're totally smart. And yes, their answer was, yes, we think about expanding. But interestingly to me, they followed up very quickly, but we're deathly afraid of doing it, lest we somehow disturb, by doing it, we somehow disturb what we have in place and have always had. So that's a problem for them more than it was for me. They'd like to. It makes a lot of sense. Everybody loves Russ and Daughters. But can they keep what they have and its soul and expand at the same time? That's their challenge.
Mark Russ Fetterman. The book is Russ and Daughters, Reflections and Recipes from the House That Herring Built. Mark, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Appreciate it. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.